I dropped my board with a clatter. Well, all I know about this stuff is enough to be scared shitless of it. Is there any reason why this has to be done tonight? He made a face. I mean, your beer coolers are running, the heat's on, even the horse out front is working. Pony. Whatever. He sighed and looked around the bar. Only if somebody wants to play pool. I nudged him with my shoulder. Is your life worth a game of pool? He thought for a moment. Seems like it has been. He placed the penny on his cock thumbnail. Heads we go for, tails we go sit in the dark with everybody else. I nodded, and he flipped the coin to me, whereupon I promptly dropped it in the pile of boards. We looked at each other. I didn't know I was supposed to catch it. He peeled another penny from the paper roll. Don't worry, I have got 49 more. You ought to be able to catch one of them. He flipped the second penny, and I snatched it from midair and slapped it on the back of my other hand. I left my palm covering the penny for a few moments, building my own little tension. Is the suspense killing you? Not really. Next, we flip to see who puts the penny in the fuse. I uncovered the coin and thanked the god we trust. It was tails. Come on, I'll buy you a Coke. I ambled along behind Henry as we joined the others at the bar itself. The walls were covered with the works of different artists who had received residencies with the Foundation. It was a mixed lot, but each piece reminded me of the individual who had occupied the adjacent barstool, and artists are always good for conversation, so long as you want to talk about their art. The small group was clustered in the bar's corner, only slightly illuminated by the dim glow of available light. There were a couple of stray hunters, still dressed in their camouflage and optical orange vests. Evidently the deer were wearing blue this year. I could make out Buck Morris, one of the local cowboys who took care of the Foundation's nominal cattle herd. He was easy to spot because of his hat, a weather-worn resistol that some oil executive had offered to buy for $250. General opinion was that Buck had missed the boat. The young man next to him wore a frayed jean jacket and had strong Cheyenne features. He must have been from out of county because I didn't know him. Next was Roger Russell, an electrician out of Powder Junction in the southern part of the county who had come up here to expand his business. Turk said that he was kind of the black sheep of the family and that he had little bastards scattered all up and down the basin. Powder River let her buck a mile wide and an inch deep. I wondered mildly why Henry and I had just been gambling with our lives while an expert nursed a C&C in the next room. Sitting next to him was probably the reason why Roger happened to be here. Vonnie Hayes was old-school Wyoming. Her grandfather had had a spread of 30,000 acres of good land. Vonnie and I had kind of known each other when we were children, but after her father had committed suicide, she was sent to boarding school, and her art life had taken her east for a number of years, where she had become an accomplished sculptress. Much later, she returned to take care of her aging mother. Bonnie and Martha had worked together on the library board and a number of other community projects in the county, and my daughter had worked for Bonnie as a housekeeper one summer. After Martha died, Katie tried to fix us up, an endeavor that Bonnie and I both viewed with equal parts humor and open-handed flirtation. Even in the dim light I could make out Bonnie's features, strong, with a lupine slant to the eyes, sandy hair pulled back in a casual bun. I leaned against the bar beside her, bumping into Roger and giving him my substantial rear. "Geez, Rog," I looked around in the darkness. "Don't you know we've got an electrical emergency on our hands here?" He carefully placed his drink back and nudged it with his fingers. "I am retired." Henry appeared on the other side of the bar, slid a Rainier to me, and leaned into Roger. "What about this penny thing?" Roger looked at him, attempting to gather himself for an answer. As he did, I looked over to Vonnie. "Boy, the things you find in the dark." She took a sip of her Chenin Blanc, Henry kept a special bottle of the white wine in the cooler for her. I'd always wanted to ask her for a sip, but had never gotten up the nerve. Her eyes glowed softly, and the corner of her lips curved into a warm, sad smile. "Hello, Walter." Undaunted by conversing with drunks, Henry continued. "Those old fuses, the big ones, you put pennies in them to get them to work?" Roger laughed. "Yes, you can, and you can also fuse every bit of the substandard wiring in this shithole and burn us all up alive." I kind of leaned Roger against the bar, stabilizing the listing that had begun as he spoke, and pulled a loose stool from the far side, placing it and myself between Roger and Vonnie. "Vonnie?" Her eyes had a way of opening a little wider when you spoke to her, then closing a little, like they were capturing what you were saying and holding on to it. I was starting to remember why I had had a crush on her, and continued. "You see this heathen devil red man across the bar here?" Her eyes glanced at Henry for a moment, then returned to mine. "He and Katie are plotting some sort of intrigue against me." Her eyes widened again, and she returned her gaze to Henry. "Is that true, Bear?" It irritated me that every woman I knew was on a cuddly first-name basis with the man. Henry nodded toward me. "White man full of shit." We were on a technicolor roll now. I was Randolph Scott to his, I don't know, one of those bigger-than-life Indians that either got beat up or killed by the end of the third reel. It's true, he's government-trained to be involved in these kinds of covert operations. I pointed to the framed boxes on the wall behind the bar that contained a burnt map of North and South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. On this map were Henry's Special Forces pin, Purple Heart, Army Distinguished Service Cross, Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry, and assorted campaign medals. There were also black-and-white photographs of Henry with his infantry platoon leaders, and one with his friend and team member, Lo Chi, whom he had brought back and relocated in Los Angeles. There was even a picture of Henry and me, wearing the two ugliest Hawaiian shirts, in Saigon on a 3-day leave in 1968. "You see all that stuff on the wall? He was trained in the war to be the gravest irritation to all those around him. There is no way a common soldier, such as myself, could possibly compete with a hand-picked, combat-hardened pain in the ass like him." Few people knew the shadowy history of the Special Operations Group that had operated out of Laos, but the numbers said it all. For every American Special Forces soldier that was lost, the North Vietnamese lost between 100 and 150 troops. The Bear had been a part of one of the most effective killing machines on either side of the war. Henry's face pushed up and curved to the side as the weight of his head held steady in the palm of his supporting hand. "Common soldier? The closest he came to any real fighting was when he agreed to meet me for a 3-day in Saigon." Under his breath he continued, but I'm pretty sure I was the only one that heard it. "Except for Ted." I left Henry to leverage Roger into doing some free electrical consulting work and turned my attention back to Vonnie. She was staring into the glass eyes of one of the mounted antelope behind the bar. "Pretty animals." Her eyes remained steady in the pronghorn. "Do you think they feel pain like we do?"
"Nope."
She turned to look at me, seemingly irritated. "Really?"
"Really."
She stayed with me for a second, and then, fading into disappointment, glanced at her wine glass. "So, you don't think they feel pain?"
"No," I said. "I don't think they feel pain like us."
"Oh."
The smile slowly returned.
"For a minute there, I thought you had become a jerk."
"No, a blacksmith's son."
She continued to smile and then nodded. "You used to come out to our place with your father, Lloyd."
I watched her. Nobody remembers his name.
"I think my mother had a little crush on him."
"Just another Longmire plying his wiles.
When I was real little, I used to make the shoeing rounds with him.
It looked painful to me, so I asked him.
What did he say?
Pop used to speak in biblical terms, but what he said was that the brutes of the field don't feel pain like humans. That's the price we pay for thinking. She took another sip of her wine.
Comforting to know that we're the species that feels the most pain.
I half closed an eye and looked at her for a second. Is that East Coast sarcasm I'm hearing?
No, that's East Coast self-pity.
Oh. I was getting in way over my head. I can do the bull about as well as it can be done, but that edgy buzz talk makes me weary in a heartbeat. I try and keep up, but after a while I start to drag. She placed a hand on mine, and I think it was the hottest hand I had ever felt.
Walter, are you all right?
It always started like this, a touch and a kind word. I used to feel heat behind my eyes and a shortness of breath, but now I just feel the emptiness. The fuses of desire are blown black windows, and I'm gone with no pennies to save me. Oh, you mean you really want to talk? Her eyes were so sad, so honest.
Yeah, I figured since we didn't have anything else to do.
So I leaned in and told her the truth. I'm just numb most of the time. She blinked.
Me too.
I felt like one of those guys in the movies, there in the foxhole, asking how much ammo your buddy's got. I got two more clips. How about you? I know the things I'm supposed to do, but I just don't seem to have the energy. I mean, I've been thinking about turning over my pillow for 3 weeks.
I know.
She looked away.
How's Katie?
Here I was, floating in the white-capped Pacific of self-pity, and Vani threw me a lifeline to keep me from embarrassing myself. Three fingers, bartender. She's great. I looked at Vani to see if she was really interested. She was. She's doing so well in Philadelphia.
She always has been special.
Yes, she is. We sat there for a moment, allowing the crackle and roar of my parental self-satisfaction to fade into the soft glow of friendly conversation. Her hand was still on my arm when the phone rang.
Looks like she's tracked you down.
The hand went away. I watched as Henry allowed it to ring the second time, his teller signature, then snatched it from the cradle. It is another beautiful evening here at the Red Pony Bar and continual soiree. How can I help you? His face pulled up on one side as if the receiver had just smacked him. Yes, he's here. He stretched the cord across the expanse of the bar and handed me the phone. His eye stayed on mine. I nudged it between my chin and shoulder with one hand, took a sip of beer with the other, and swallowed. Hello, Sugar Blossom.
Hello, Shithead. The voice on the other end said, "It's not a dead sheep."
I stood there, letting the world shift at quarter points, and then got a bearing and dropped my voice. "What have we got?" Every eye in the bar was on me. Vic's voice held an edge that I had never heard before, approaching an excitement under the grave suppression of businesslike boredom.
Male, Caucasian, approximately 21 years of age. One entry wound, characteristic of maybe a 30-06.
I started to rub my eyes, noticed that my hand was shaking, and put it in my pocket. All right, call the store and tell them to send the little lady. There was a brief pause, and I listened to the static from a radio on 137 patch through to a landline in Durant.
You don't want any cashiers?
No, just the bag boys. I've got a highly dependable staff.
She laughed. "'Where did you get out here? These fucking sheep have been marching around on everything. I think the little bastards actually ate some of his clothes, and they shit on him.'
"'Great. Past the Hudson Bridge. You got your lights on?'
"'Yep.'
She paused for a moment, and I listened to the static.
"'Walt?'
I had started to hang up the phone.
"'Yeah. You better bring some beer to quiet Bob and Billy down.'
This was a first.
"'You bet.'
I started to hang up again.
"'Walt?'
"'Yep.
It's Cody Pritchard.'
Chapter 2 There's nothing like a dead body to make you feel, well, removed. I guess the big city boys cataloging 40 or 50 homicides a year get used to it, but I never have. I've been around enough wildlife and stock that it's pretty commonplace, the mechanics of death. There's a religion worthy of this rite of passage, of taking that final step from being a vertical creature to a horizontal one. Yesterday you were just some nobody. Today you're the honored dead with bread bags rubber-banded over your hands. I secure what's left of my dwindling humanity with the false confidence of the living, the deceitful wit of the 8-foot-tall and bulletproof. Yea, verily, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will live forever. If I don't, I sure as hell won't become an unattended death in the state of Wyoming with sheep shit all over me. We had pretty much done our work, secured the area, lit it up, and finished taking pictures. There's a kind of cocksure attitude that overtakes a man in the presence of the dearly departed. A you're dead and I'm not kind of perspective. There's something about a carcass of an animal like oneself, the post-shuffled mortal coil, that brings out the worst in me. And I start thinking that I'm funny. I've been thinking about a search-and-rescue sheep squad. I picked some of the dried shit from my pants and flicked it from my fingernails. The way I figure it, the sheep would work up a damn storm and never raise any hell about working conditions. Might even get rid of some of this leafy spurge. I looked around at the frosted, milky yellow plants that had been half-eaten by the buying, attending witnesses we had corralled at the base of the hill. I had been here for 9 hours, and the sun was beginning to scatter the gray blocks that made up the eastern horizon. The crime scene was a slight depression at the middle of a wreath-shaped ridge. "What do you think?" TJ raised an eyebrow from her clipboard.
"Cody Allen Pritchard."
She returned the eyebrow to the hunting license and wallet that were clipped to the official forms.
"DOB 8181. Kind of has a ring to it."
Cody had looked better. Whoever had dispatched the young man had done so with a smooth and consistent pull-off as center shot. From the back, it looked as though someone had drilled a perfectly round hole between Cody's shoulder blades. From the front, it looked as though someone had driven a stagecoach through him. The body was lying face down, all the limbs arranged in a normal fashion, arms at the sides with palms turned to the lemon-colored sky. I was tempted to see if Cody's lifeline was abnormally short, but his hands had already been bagged. A green John Deere hat with an adjustable strap in the back had been carted off with the unfired Model 94 Winchester 30-30 that had been found at his side. His clothes were in bad shape, even for a person who had had more than 10 cc's of lead pushed through him at approximately 2,500 feet per second. The sheep had done a number on him. The orange vest was torn where they had tried to eat it. The sleeves of his flannel shirt were shredded, and even his work boots looked as though they had been nibbled on. They had slept on him, gleaning the last energies of the late Cody Pritchard as his body cooled. Finally, much to the dissatisfaction of the crime lab people, they had shit on him. I gestured to the sheep down the hill. "I'm assuming that you're going to want to question all the witnesses." T.J. Sherwin had been the director of the Division of Criminal Investigations Lab Unit for 17-odd years. I had always called her the Little Lady, as opposed to many of the other nicknames that periodically circulated through Wyoming's law enforcement community. Bitch on Wheels, the Wicked Witch of the West,
the bag lady? The last referred to the Division of Criminal Investigations Home Away From Home, a converted grocery in Cheyenne, commonly tagged as the store. Hence, DCI lab personnel were routinely called bag boys, and criminal investigators were cashiers. When I first met TJ, she had informed me that I was just the kind of dinosaur she was going to make a personal career of eradicating. As the years passed and we worked numerous cases together, I remained a dinosaur, but I was her favorite dinosaur.
"So what do you think?"
She had finally lowered the clipboard. "He doesn't look like a deer." I gave Cody another study.
"Walt, let's drop the aw shucks bullshit. This is one of the boys that was involved in that rape case 2 years ago."
TJ had held my hand through the Little Bird rape investigation, introducing me to the world of secretors, medical swabs, and gynecological exams. "Yeah, well, I'll follow up on the home front. He wasn't any angel. We'll go through the licensees and hopefully find some poor dumb bastard from Minnesota that got a little trigger-happy."
"You don't think it was an accident?"
I thought about it. Like I said, he wasn't an altar boy.
"You have a feeling about this?"
I started to give her the old Colonel Mustard in the library with the candlestick routine, but thought better of it. "No, I don't." When we got back, the bag boys had already zipped Cody up and loaded him onto a gurney. Some of the others were still processing evidence into freezer bags. One of the boys was dropping a tattered eagle feather into a plastic envelope. He looked up as we approached. "Looks like everything out here has been making a meal of this poor guy." TJ turned to me.
"Walt, are you going to be the primary on this one?"
"Do you mean am I going to be riding in one of those Conestoga wagons of yours for 5 hours down to Cheyenne?"
"Yes."
"No." I pointed to the group of vehicles where Vic was busy putting away the photography equipment. "At the bottom of this hill you will find my somewhat agitated but highly skilled primary investigator." TJ smiled. She liked Vic.
"She have any cases pending?"
"Well, she's been hanging Christmas lights in town, but I figure we can let her go for a few days."
"It's not even Thanksgiving."
"It's a city council thing." We followed the body down to where the rest of our little task force had congregated. Someone had brought a number of thermoses full of hot coffee and a few boxes of donuts. I got a cup of coffee. I don't eat donuts. I spotted Jim Ferguson, one of my deputies, and head of search and rescue, across the bed of the truck, and asked him if they had turned anything up on their walk-around. His mouth was full of cream-filled, but the gist was no. I told him I was going to replace his staff with the sheep. "We did a 300-yard perimeter, but the light wasn't so good. We'll do another as soon as everybody gets a donut and some coffee. You think this guy left brass?"
"I hope."
I took my coffee and moved over to where TJ and Vic were seated on a tailgate. They were looking at some of the evidence. Hopefully they were discussing something I could understand.
"Single shot, center. Didn't get too much of the sternum."
Vic held a bag up to the rising sun and looked at the metal fragment inside.
"Fuck, I don't know."
TJ patted the spot beside her with the palm of her hand, and I sat. Vic continued.
"It looks like a slug. I'm thinking 12-gauge or something just a little bigger."
"Bazooka?" She lowered the bag, and her eyes met mine.
"You're getting rid of me?"
I nodded my head. "Yep."
"Why?"
"Because you're a big pain in the butt."
"Fuck you."
"And you talk dirty."
She handed the bagged bullet to TJ. "You're going to be stuck up here with Turk."
"Yeah, well, maybe we'll get the Christmas lights put up together." Mick snorted and readjusted her gun belt. "Besides, you've forgotten more about this space-age stuff than I'll ever know. You can relay information back to me." The tarnished gold stared at me, unblinking. "You'll only be down there for 2 days. It'll take us that long to round up all the usual suspects." I was the old dog who had learned his fill of new tricks, and it was only logical that I work the county and the people. She poked me in the belly. Her finger remained in one of my fat rolls, and she poked each word for emphasis.
If search and rescue don't find anything, you gonna call Omar?
That's another reason for you to leave. You don't like Omar.
She poked me again. You be careful, all right?
This all sounded very strange coming from Vic's mouth, but I took it as a fiction and punched her on the shoulder. I'm always... She knocked my hand away.
I mean it.
She didn't have kind eyes. They rarely looked away, and they always told the truth. I could use eyes like that.
I've got a funny feeling about all of this.
I gazed back up to the patch of sage and scrub weed and watched the sun free itself from the red hills. Yeah, well, you got 5 hours to talk to TJ about this woman's intuition thing. The next poke hurt. I hung around the scene until search and rescue had finished their second sweep. I sat in the bullet and filled out the reports. Ferg strolled up with a cup of coffee and another cream-filled. Anything? Fortunately, I caught him between bites. Nothing. We got a lot of sheep shit and tracks. Any suspicious sheep tracks? Nope. No suspicious sheep shit either. It's like the Denver stockyards up there. I thought about how you could kill a victim only once, but how a crime scene could die 1,000 deaths. I hoped that whatever useful information could be deducted from this patch of God's little acre was traveling safely in plastic bags toward Cheyenne. Motives are all fine and good, but if we could find out the how, we'd have a shooting's match chance of finding out the who. I had the niggling feeling I was going to have to call Omar. On the drive over to the Pritchards' place, I thought about the last time I had seen Cody alive. He was a heavy-set kid, built like a linebacker, curly blonde hair and pale blue eyes. He had his mother's looks, his father's temper, and nobody's brains. I'd pulled him out on 3 occasions, the last being the rape case. Cody had endeared himself to the local Native American community by being quoted in the Sheridan paper as saying, "Yeah, she was a retard redskin, but she was asking for it." The Pritchards had a place on the outskirts of Durant, and by the time I got there, there must have been 8 or 9 cars and trucks in the drive. Word carries fast in open spaces. As I cut off the engine, the full impact of what I was going to have to do hit me like a Burlington Northern. How do you tell parents that their child is dead? Sure, they'd heard it through the grapevine, but I was the official word. I allowed myself a long sigh. There were field swallows swooping near the bullet. I was probably disturbing their family, too. Seemed to be my day for it. It had been longer than 24 hours since sleep. It's easy to work all night because the sun doesn't come up, but when it does, my eyes start to sting and the rest of me gets a little shaky. I've always been this way. I was focusing my eyes when I heard the screen door slam and saw John Pritchard walking down the drive. I never cared too much for John. He was one of those guys who always had to be in control. The conversation wasn't as bad as it could have been. The pertinent information from him was that Cody had left the house 27 hours ago with an extra dough license. The pertinent information from me was that he wasn't coming home. I did the best I could, drove the 7 miles back to my place and sat on the porch, well, the front doorway, but not for very long because it was cold. I had the presence of mind to fall into the house instead of out of it. I drifted in and out of consciousness until the phone rang, and the answering machine my daughter made me buy picked up. "You've reached the Longmire residence. No one is available to answer your call right now, 'cause we're out chasing bad guys or trying on white hats. If you leave a message after the tone, we'll get back to you as quickly as we can. Happy trails." She had taken a great deal of joy in recording the message printed in the instructions with a few minor alterations. I smiled every time I heard it. "It's pancake day," the voice resonated through the lines from 14 miles away. Jim Ferguson was not only head of search and rescue and my longest-standing part-time deputy, but he was also the man in charge of driving around Durant once a year at dawn in the fire department's truck, proclaiming through a bullhorn, "It's Pancake Day! Pancake Day!" There are only three major vote-getting days in Absaroka County, and I can remember the other two. Oh, God, no, it's Pancake Day. I thought about shooting myself. I could see the headline, "Sheriff Shoots Self Unable to Face Pancakes." "It's Pancake Day." Ferg really enjoyed his work. "I've been trying to get a hold of you for the last hour. Just thought somebody ought to call and remind you, but if you really are going to retire next year, then who gives a shit?" I stumbled to the phone beside the recliner. "Is it really today?" "If I'm lying, I'm dying." There was a pause. "Hey, Walt, if you want, I can just tell him we were up all night." Ferg was slightly in the Turk camp for future sheriff, but I had other plans. If Vic was going to be the first female sheriff in Wyoming, I only had a year to pull in all my political markers. I could last an hour of Pancake Day with the Elks, the Eagles, the Lions, the J.C.s, the Daughters of the American Revolution, and, of course, the AARPs. I'll be there in a half hour.
"Remember, it's at the Catholic Church this year."
"You bet." I plugged in the coffee maker and dumped enough coffee for 8 cups into the filter with only enough water for 4. I took a shower while it was perking. The plumbing was somewhat makeshift, but the water that came from above went away below. It went away below through a bathtub that Henry had found for me for $20. Somebody on the res had used it for target practice with a .22, but had only chipped the porcelain. Then there was a shower curtain. I don't know what the exact physical dynamics are that cause a shower curtain to attach itself to your body when you turn on the water, but since my shower was surrounded on all sides by curtains, I turned on the water and became a vinyl, vacuum-sealed sheriff burrito. I slid behind the wheel of the Bullet and started driving the 14 miles to town. Durant is situated along the Bighorn Mountains, and because there is abundant fish and game, it's become the retiree capital of Wyoming. In Absaroka County, to ignore the octogenarian vote is to pump gas at the Sinclair Station for a living. Service jobs are about all there are in Durant, somewhat stunting the younger generation and forcing the majority out by age 19. But the retirees keep coming from Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa, with the odd Texan and Californian thrown in for spice. They come looking for the romance of the West that they had paid shiny quarters to view on Saturday afternoons in flickering black and white. They waited half a century of stamping out automobile bumpers to get their Western dream. They paid for it, and by God, they were going to have it. Most ended up picking up and moving out, headed for Florida, Arizona, or wherever the weather was easier. I liked the ones who stayed. You'd see them out after the blizzards, shoveling away and waving at the Bullet like it was the circus come to town. Hell, I'd stop and talk to them. Sheriffs have to get elected in Wyoming, so we have to be liked. I imagine that if you had to elect the average police force, the turnover rate would spin your Rolodex. When I first started out, it was the part of the job that I enjoyed the least, courting the public. But as time wore on, it got to be the part that I enjoyed the most. Martha was right when she said that I needed a bumper sticker that said, "Born to Bullshit." The debates were the best part. In 81, old Sheriff Connolly planned a peaceful takeover. He ran against me so no one else could and had lofted softballs to me so that I felt like Harmon Killebrew by the time the debate was over. I was elected. Lucian retired and was now living the high life in room 32 at the Durant Home for Assisted Living. I still went over on Tuesday nights to play chess, and he still kicked my ass, to his unending delight. I looked at the inch of snow that dappled the sagebrush. It looked like a Morse code of white dots and dashes leading down the road. If I could read the message, would it tell me the story I wanted to hear? The truth still stood that I was a sheriff who had survived by the cult of personality, and that if the trend were to continue, my heir apparent wouldn't be elected. Was I just trying to force Vic down the throats of the county because I could? No, she was the best person for the job, and that was the reason I was going to have to keep pushing. Pancake day, pancake day. I idled down into second gear at the corner of Main and Bighorn and looked down the street to see Turk's Trans Am parked at the office. Just seeing his car made my ass hurt. I didn't feel like facing him on an empty stomach. I hoped he would have already contacted Lavanda Running Horse over at Game and Fish for any information we could get about last night's incident. I circled quickly around the courthouse to avoid being seen and made a beeline for the Catholic Church. The place was mobbed, and there was no parking. I wheeled the Bullet under the concrete pad beside the HVAC unit and cut the engine. I figured the Pope wasn't coming today. Well, if it isn't the long arm of the law! It was an old joke, but one I didn't mind. Longmire, pull up a chair and sit yourself down. Steve Brandt was the mayor of Durand, and the de facto president of the Business Associates Committee, a loosely affiliated group of warring tribes that made up the commercial facet of the downtown. He also owned the screen printing place on Main and had done the T-shirts for the annual Sheriff's Department versus Fire Department softball game. But the less said about this, the better. Next to him was David Fielding of the sports shop, Elaine Geary, who had the art gallery, Joe of Joe Benham's Hardware and Lumber, Dan Crawford from the IGA, and Ruby. "What are you doing here?" Ruby's chin rested on her palm, fingers trailing into the hollow below her cheekbones. "I figured cheekbones were one of those things you gained from speedwalking 5 miles a day. I slipped off my coat and sat on it. Well, I'm here to support the courageous Durant Volunteer Fire Department's men in non-flammable nylon. Do you think their hats are cooler than ours?
Shouldn't you be home in bed?"
I took my hat and perched it on her head. It looked jaunty. I turned to the others at the table. "This is the problem I have with all the women I know. They're always trying to get me into bed." There was a derisive chuckle around the table, and Ruby took my hat off, sitting it on the table, brim up. Good Wyoming girl. "It's 'cause I look so much like Gary Cooper." General opinion at the table projected their cinematic consensus to more like Hoot Gibson, whereupon I changed the subject. "So, how are the pancakes?"
"We don't know. We've been here for 20 minutes and ain't seen a damn pancake yet."
Joe Benham was in a lean and hungry mood.
"Might be for the best. They aren't letting the firemen cook again, are they?"
"You'd think they'd learn to not trust him with fire."
David's comment referred to the infamous stove oil incident, wherein the firemen had set fire to the old wood-burning stove at the Future Farmers of America Hall, resulting in that year's pancakes tasting roughly like roofing shingles.
"The best was when they almost burned their truck up at that grass fire out near you."
Elaine, being a patron of the arts, always appreciated spectacle. Ruby placed a steaming styrofoam cup of coffee in front of me. I hadn't even seen her get up. "Thank you, ma'am." I took a sip and listened to the rumble as it joined the other 4 cups in my stomach. I was hungry, and that was not a good thing on pancake day.
"We were just discussing the city Christmas decorations, Walt. Do you think they're the ugliest in Wyoming?"
Elaine had a twinkle in her eye. As part of the city council, she had been lobbying for new decorations for about 6 years now. The problem was that Joe's father had designed and executed the offending artistry of Santa, elves, reindeer, bells, wreaths, candles, trees, mistletoe, holly, stars, and toys 25 years ago. Say what you want about 3/4-inch exterior ply, it holds ugly for a long time.
"Gillettes are uglier," I ventured.
"We heard you had a busy night."
Dan Crawford picked up his coffee and blew into it, watching the swirls of cream separate at the riptide on the other side of his cup. It got quiet. This was going to be the prime topic of conversation for the morning, so I might as well develop an official line. Nothing big. We had a hunting accident out near 137 on BLM land. I tried to make it sound like the end of the story.
We heard there was a boy dead.
Dan continued to look at his coffee.
Well, what else have you heard?
It got even quieter. No offense, Dan, but I'm not going to sit here and play guessing games with you. Why don't you just tell me what you know, and I'll either confirm or deny it or not. His face reddened, which was not what I was after. I didn't mean anything, Walt. Just curious. He meant it. I rubbed my face with my hands and looked at all of them. I hope you'll all excuse me, but it's been a long night. I sighed. With all due respect to the ongoing investigation, it would appear that on the night past, one Cody Pritchard departed for the far country from which no traveler born returns. The illusion was not lost on Elaine.
Have you narrowed it down to a couple of 100,000 suspects, as in something rotten in the state of Denmark or Iowa?
Joe nodded.
Well, I don't figure there'll be any public outcries of mourning.
Elaine ventured that there might be a parade, then saved me by asking if I was willing to play The Ghost of Christmas Future in the Civic Theater's upcoming production of A Christmas Carol. I was pretty sure that she wanted me for my height and not my dramatic skills. This was confirmed when she assured me that I wouldn't have to learn any lines, and that all I had to do was point. I excused myself to see a man about a horse, and made for the boys' room at the far end of the hall. On the way, I got a peek through the kitchen service opening, and was startled to see Vonnie Hayes sliding a stacked platter of pancakes to a waiting fireman. She looked much as she did last evening, which seemed like another life. Her hand came up and swiped back a stray wisp of hair that had escaped from the loose bun. It's funny how the little movements that a woman makes seem so individualized, like a signature. It was the rotation of the wrist with a two-finger pull. I gave it a 10 and was aroused. I waved and thought she had seen me, but maybe I was wrong. She smiled at the young fireman and disappeared into the kitchen. Those firemen, they make out like bandits. In the boys' room, I attended to business, washed my hands, hit the button on the hand dryer, and wiped my hands off on my pants to the quiet hum of modern technology. It was then that I realized I was wearing my weapon. I don't wear my gun to community functions, and I don't wear it on weekends. I was actually famous for taking it off and leaving it places. Periodically, Vic would bring it back to me from the bathroom in the office or out of the seat of the bullet. She liked to make fun of my antique armament by calling it the blunderbuss. Heavy, hard to aim, slow rate of fire, it was the weapon I had used in Vietnam for 4 years, and I'd gotten used to it. The Colt 1911 A1 had a grisly but effective past. During the Philippine campaigns, the islanders took to getting doped up and wrapping themselves in sugarcane. United States servicemen had the glorious experience of shooting these natives numerous times with no result before being hacked to death by their machetes. Obviously something with a little more hitting power than the standard issue 38 was needed. John Browning's auto-loading, single-action child graduated to .45 caliber, and the Filipinos began flying back out of the trenches they had hurled themselves into. Unaccurized, the weapon was about as precise as a regulation basketball, but if you hit something with it, chances were good the fight was over. I thumbed the standard duty holster open and took the weapon out to check it, an old habit. The matte finish was rubbed off at the sights and the ridges along the barrel's slide action. Fully loaded, which it was, it regularly weighed 38.6 ounces. But today it seemed to weigh about 3 tons. What the hell was it doing on? Was I responding to some unconscious threat? Did I know more than I thought I knew?